horn to Yosef. Is this already recorded?
Yes.
Wow. So, right in the middle, here we go. There's no intro to this. This is the, are we about the 16th of July, 2016? It's the Shabbat morning Bible study. We're reading from Genesis 41, 38, maybe to 42, 18. And I'll continue reading. We're picking up at verse 50. Two sons were born to Joseph before the famine came. Asnath, daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, was their mother. Joseph named the firstborn Manasseh, saying, "Certainly God has made me forget all my troubles and all my father's house." He named the second child Ephraim, saying, "Certainly God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering." Just a second here. Yeah. The 7 years of abundance in the land of Egypt came to an end. And then the 7 years of famine began, just as Joseph had predicted. There was famine in all the other lands, but throughout the land of Egypt there was food. When all the land of Egypt experienced the famine, the people cried out to Pharaoh for food. And Pharaoh said to the people, "Go to Joseph. Do whatever he tells you." While the famine was all over the earth, Joseph opened the storehouses and sold grain to the Egyptians. The famine was severe throughout the land of Egypt. People from every country came to Joseph in Egypt to buy grain because the famine was severe throughout the earth. When Jacob heard that there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why are you looking at each other? Look, I hear there's grain down in Egypt. Go down there and buy grain for us so that we may live and not die." So 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain from Egypt. But Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers, for he said, "What if some accident happens to him?" So Israel's sons came to buy grain among the other travelers, for the famine was severe in the land of Canaan. Now Joseph was the ruler of the country, the one who sold grain to all the people of the country. Joseph's brothers came and bowed down before him with their faces to the ground. And when he saw his brothers, he recognized them. But he pretended to be a stranger to them and spoke to them harshly. And he asked, "Where do you come from?" And they answered, "From the land of Canaan to buy grain for food." One wonders, because later it mentions an interpreter, one wonders how they were talking here, presumably an interpreter. Anyway, Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. Then Joseph remembered the dreams he dreamt about them, and he said, "You're spies. You've come to see if our land is vulnerable." But they exclaimed, "No, my lord, your servants have come to buy grain for food. We are all sons of one man. We are honest men. Your servants are not spies." "No, but you have come to see if our land is vulnerable." And they said, "Your servants are from a family of 12 brothers. We're the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. The youngest is with our father at this time, and one is no longer alive." But Joseph said, "It is just as I said to you. You are spies. You'll be tested in this way. As surely as Pharaoh lives, you will not depart from this place unless your youngest brother comes here. One of you must go and get your brother while the rest of you remain in prison. And in this way, your words may be tested to see if you are telling the truth. If not, then as surely as Pharaoh lives, you are spies." And he imprisoned them all for 3 days. Okay. It was a little long, but we got through it.
You realize it's 2 weeks.
Oh, this is 2 weeks?
Yeah,
why?
Because officially it ends at 42.1. And next week starts at 40. That's according to the list. It doesn't matter.
Oh.
The list also says 38 and 38.8.
Hold it a second. Let me check this out. Okay. So I just read 2.
No. It was great reading. I love this NET version. What does NET mean?
New
English Translation. It's very good.
It's an online version.
Yeah, it's very nice.
And it's got footnotes, and that's actually why it's fun for English. Now, so I guess we go back. We'll stick. That helps. Thank you. We will stick to the part before 42. So we will leave out the story about the brothers and the spies.
Right.
And we'll go back to earlier questions. However, before we do, we have one more passage to read. Let me check, since you have the list, I want to check it.
Isaiah 11:2.
Did I double read it? No,
no
I didn't
no,
this
no.
time. Isaiah 11, 2 through 16. So, since you liked it, I will keep reading from the NET Bible, and that makes all of you listen because it's not anybody's exact version. I'm going to start with the first verse. A shoot will grow out of Jesse's root stock. A bud will sprout from his roots. The Lord's Spirit will rest on him. A spirit that gives extraordinary wisdom, a spirit that provides the ability to execute plans, a spirit that produces absolute loyalty to the Lord. He will delight in obeying the Lord. He will not judge men by mere appearances or make decisions on the basis of hearsay. He will treat the poor fairly and make right decisions for the downtrodden of the earth. And he will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth and order the wicked to be executed. Justice will be like a belt around his waist. Integrity will be like a belt around his hips. A wolf will reside with a lamb, and a leopard will lie down with a young goat. An ox and a young lion will graze together, and a small child leads them along. A cow and a bear will graze together. Their young will lie down together. A lion, like an ox, will eat straw. A baby will play over the hole of a snake. Over the nest of a serpent, an infant will put his hand. They will no longer injure or destroy on my entire royal mountain. There will be universal submission to the Lord's sovereignty, just as the waters completely cover the sea. At that time, a root from Jesse will stand like a signal flag for the nations. Nations will look to him for guidance, and his residence will be majestic. At that time, the sovereign master will again lift his hand to reclaim the remnant of his people from Assyria, Egypt, Patros, Cush, Elam, Shinar, Hamat, and the seacoasts. He will lift a signal flag for the nations. He will gather Israel's dispersed people and assemble Judah's scattered people from the four corners of the earth. Ephraim's jealousy will end, and Judah's hostility will be eliminated. Ephraim will no longer be jealous of Judah, and Judah no longer hostile towards Ephraim. They will swoop down on the Philistine hills to the west. Together they will loot the people of the east. They will take over Edom and Moab, and the Ammonites will be their subjects. The Lord will divide the gulf of the Egyptian Sea. He will wave his hand over the Euphrates and send a strong wind. He will turn it into 7 dried up streams and enable them to walk across in their sandals. There will be a highway leading out of Assyria for the remnant of his people, just as there was for Israel when they went up from the land of Egypt. Okay. That's the chosen parasha for this session. And we'll be able to read some of it, I think, and make nice comparisons with the Joseph story, which will explain why it was chosen. But there are quite a few, there's quite a few problems for interpretation. Exactly how we're supposed to make sense of the text, and I don't know fully how to make sense of the text. I can see some of the pieces of the big picture, but some of those pieces raise questions that brings me back to not being able to give definitive answers. I don't know if that's a good thing or not. Some people really don't like indecision, uncertainty. Unfortunately, when I read this text, I end up with indecision and uncertainty. So knowing that ahead of time, please have patience with me. Okay? Now, that's way too much to deal with in the next, let's say, half hour. So I'd like to jump back to Genesis, pick out a couple not so significant but cryptic things that are in the Genesis text, and then I'd like to come back to Isaiah 11, because that's where, to me, where the challenging interpretation is, and start cross-reading Isaiah 11 with Genesis 41. So, if we jump back to Genesis 41, verse 38 and following, I might ask, I guess I could let people ask questions first. Does anybody have a question over the first part from Genesis 41, 38 to the end of the chapter, which would be verse 57. Are there any questions of understanding that people have?
Who was on?
I'm sorry?
Who was on?
Who was On?
Yes.
On was a name. It was a
name of God.
Yeah, let's see here, hold on. That's what I thought. Another name for the city of Heliopolis.
But it says that Osnath's father was a Greek with On.
Yes, but On is a, well, first of all, he's an Egyptian priest, so it's part of the Egyptian cult, that is true. And On is an alternate name for a city, and I just checked, and it said, this note said that it's the city of Heliopolis.
Isn't that connected with the sun?
Yes. Helio
sun.
Means sun. It's coming out of, let's see, Helios. Helios. It's coming out of Greek. And Heliopolis is the sun city.
It was the later name of the city.
I'm sorry?
The Greeks weren't there yet. It was the later name, right?
Yes, Heliopolis, of course, would be the Greek name for the same, for that city.
So there's the worship of the sun and On.
But it's, I'm glad, let me go on with the question, because I think it brings up something that is, it's an aside, but it's between the lines, and it has disturbed people, not just in the modern world, but in the ancient world, as you'll hear in a minute. If Asnat is the daughter of an Egyptian priest, presumably she is a a pagan idolatress. And what is our man of God doing marrying a pagan idolatress to raise his children? Yes, is that a fair question?
Yeah.
Or, and I may, maybe, is that part of the reason for your question? God is with him, yes.
And he's not talking about Om, obviously.
Yes, or the gods of Om, or the, they might have had a, they, I don't know which god might have been there as the chief temple, but they had various gods in the Egyptian pantheon.
But we wouldn't think that was the god that was with Yosef, right?
Joseph, no, Joseph, when Joseph is talking, he's talking about the true God, the creator of the world. With
yeah,
the, made
Pharaoh was recognizing that because he's saying God is with him.
Yes.
But the gods of the Egyptians were like nothing.
Very good. That is true. Now the question is, what is Joseph doing marrying a pagan daughter? And this question arose in antiquity when people read the story and they found an answer, or they created an answer, and they wrote a book called Joseph and Asnat. Have any of you read Joseph and Asnat? No. It's actually a very interesting read, and it's written, it's preserved for us in Greek. I'm not.
It's in the pseudepigrapha.
It's in the pseudepigrapha. So it's a, I think it's typically dated to the first century. It's very difficult to date some of these things. Well, it's not part of the. It's not part of the apocrypha. Somebody can correct me. I don't think Joseph and Asnat are part of the Latin Vulgate canon. They so it's we call it it's part of what we call intertestamental literature. It's Jewish literature that was written after the what we call the Hebrew Bible, the canon. And most of this literature was all written in a pre-Christian time. And there's a whole long list of works. Many of them are very valuable for understanding and interpreting what we read in the New Testament. For instance, the Book of Enoch is not in the Latin Apocrypha, and yet it's quoted in the Book of Jude. So these, we call them pseudepigrapha, which means literally not as ascribed, because the Book of Enoch is called the Book of Enoch, but today at least, nobody believes that the Book of Enoch was written by Enoch. And that's where this name pseudepigrapha comes from. It's falsely attributed to. But we have a lot of books like this written during this time, after the Hebrew Bible, before the New Testament. And Yosef and Asnat are one of these books. And so sometimes people refer to the Apocrypha, like books of Maccabees, the Wisdom of Sirach, and other things that are in your Greek Septuagint. And they got translated. They're canonical for the Greek Orthodox Church, and they were translated into Latin for the Vulgate. But there were lots of other books, and many of them were also translated as well. Some of them even show up at Qumran, like Tobit, the story of Tobit, very similar to Joseph and Asnat in the sense of being a kind of romantic novel. Well, Tobit is in the Septuagint, so it is apocryphal. One of the apocryphal books. And it shows up in Qumran in both a Hebrew copy and an Aramaic copies. So it was so well liked that it was in multiple languages and preserved down at Qumran. Well, anyway, back to this book. How did they solve the problem? They wrote a historical novel where Asnat converts. She becomes a follower of the Lord. Problem solved. So there are creative ways to solve some of the problems. Now, I guess I could say I could say the same thing as a little preview when we come to Isaiah 11, where we have the lion and the lamb scenario, as it's typically referred to in English, the lion and the lamb lying down together, but the lion only wants to eat straw. Well, how do you deal with this? Well, C.S. Lewis has a whole trilogy of science fiction where people are living in different worlds following strange rules, and I believe it's in his first book where the guy named Ransom goes off what is what we would call Mars, I guess, and talks to people there and animals that talk and actually kill each other. They have fighting and they die. They do not live forever. And so he's written a novel, and he has a world view that is divine, and yet it has death in it. Now that's different from the way people read.
Well, why is it divine if it's Mars?
Well, it's not tainted by sin. It's outside of the fallen world of Earth, and he visits a world where there's been no fall, where everything is, as you know, everything is on track, but they have different grades of beings, and yet some of the beings are like what we would call animals, and are slated for death. Yet they can talk. So anyway, how many have read that?
No.
Oh, both of us. Okay.
But you know, I saw her 11.
I read it 40 years ago, so my memory's a little fuzzy. Anyway.
But in Isaiah 11, the sort of the lack of everybody eating each other, destroying each other, kids sitting on top of vipers' nests and so on, is that saying that death doesn't exist? Or is it simply saying that the glory of the Lord, everything will be restored into a different
and no one will kill anybody.
It's a return to Genesis 1.
Hmm?
That's all it is.
Genesis 1, yeah.
Sharon, I didn't hear what you said.
A return to Genesis 1.
A return to Genesis 1.
Yeah.
Genesis
where people
1,
don't eat meat.
Lions ate grass.
Right.
So, in Isaiah 11, lions eat grass.
Right.
A vegan
good
utopia.
There you go.
Okay, so let's come back. Let's finish up with some notes on Genesis 41, and then we'll jump to Isaiah 11. So, yes, that's a problem. And Joseph's whole life in Egypt would raise some questions, but none of that is dealt with in our text. Let me just go on briefly, because his name has sometimes caused questions. It said here, Zaphnat Phaneah, and the commentary I just read said that it means something like the hidden things to be revealing, which would make good sense because Joseph has just explained the Pharaoh's dream and has received confirmation through, well, actually not yet, but he's had the dreams and so this name reflects that. And that is, when you read it in Hebrew, that's exactly what it sounds like. What I have not done is my homework to trace the history of those Hebrew words to find out when they are attested to mean that and how we know that is what they're meaning. And the reason I'm having some doubts is because it pretty clearly says that in Hebrew when you're reading it, and yet all of the English commentators and the Net Bible says we don't know what it means, and they're trying to put it back into Egyptian, and they're trying to make the Egyptian figure out what the Egyptian would have said, and that's where nobody knows what it means. And so has his name, because it's in a transliteration, we're assuming that's what his name sounded like, but has that name actually been modified into something else so that in Hebrew it sounds like, you know, the hidden things are to be revealed?
It's kind of like Svanya. Svanya means like hidden things of God. You know, so it's basically the same name as Svanya.
Same name as what?
Svanya.
Ah, Svanya. Yes, very good. Svanya. So,
his point is that that is Hebrew.
And that's Hebrew.
So this name, if the Pharaoh gives it, should technically be Egyptian. So what happened is did the Hebrew then translate the Egyptian name and take the meaning and put it in Hebrew?
Did they Hebrew, in other words, did they Hebraize the name so that when we read it, it sounds, it gives meaning?
Like Moses versus Moshe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To pull out of the water. Exactly. So anyway, there are questions about the name, but if you want to know what it really sounds like, it sounds like hidden things are revealed. Very good. Okay, so we'll leave it there and go on. That at least gives us, I think, the sense of what it sounds like when you read this story in Hebrew. And there's one more. We discussed Asnat and her character. The other word that I was thinking about, it's always puzzled me. Why did they run around and say Avrech, Avrech? And it sounds like kneel down, but in Hebrew, if you said kneel down, you would say Havrech, Havrech.
It's French.
Exactly. And this time when I was reading it, I thought, oh, Avrech, Avrech. If any of you speak French or know someone who does, they do not like to say the ash.
I'm Vavrech.
When they talk about...
When
they talk about somebody giving some help or going to an hospital, they do not like to pronounce the ash, or the ash. So we actually have examples in antiquity of people that talked like that with Canaanite, that's another Hebrew is a dialect of Canaanite. So where did people? And we have people talking like that today. Anybody goes down to Tel Aviv and you'll wonder where the hay went. They made a song about that. You know, Horaima hay. I guess they had lost it. I don't know. They lost their hay and they were looking for it. No. But in antiquity, the Phoenicians, coastlands, these are the international seafarers, the Phoenicians, running around, didn't pronounce hays very well. How do we know that? Because they have one of the shapes of the Hebrew verb is called hithil. And when the Phoenicians were writing their language, their dialect, they would write ifil, no hay. They would write a yud in there, and they would write ifil. So, there were people running around without a hay, and I'm thinking that this author is foreignizing the word so that he is saying Havrech without the hay, and he's writing Avrech. But That's a guess, and I haven't seen that anywhere in the commentary, so I might be way out on a limb, but that's how it strikes me. Sharon, you're smiling. Does it strike you that way also, or?
Sure. I was smiling to see whether you were going to comment on Ben-Hator, but I don't think you have the time.
I do not have the time,
What's
Ben-Hator.
The meaning of this between H and H, or with the H and without the H? What's
normal,
the difference in meaning?
Normal form would be Havrech.
If you were speaking Hebrew, you would say Havrech. Well, and it actually means kneeling down. It's like what you'd say to somebody to what to do with the camel, you know, get
kneel.
The camel to drop, you know, drop the camel so you can get off, and you'd say Havrech. So, the question is does this actually mean that, or is Havrech a word we don't even know? Or is it some kind of bless him, some kind of foreign word that's it's got the same root, and you know, like say hail to Caesar as he drives past. I don't know. But
you dropped the H in good English. You're married, ain't you? I ain't saying I ain't. Asking ain't you is.
Yes, exactly. That's like when I wanted to buy a ticket on the underground, and I walked up and I said, so how many quid will that be? And he says, well, it'll be free. Now those of you
how
that,
many quid?
So how many quid will that be? And he says, it'll be free. And I almost turned around and walked away. But I had been in London a little bit too long, and I knew there were dialects where they couldn't pronounce "th."
Your own grandson has that dialect.
My own grandson has. So the guy was trying to say three, and I did pay the money because he wasn't going to give it to me for free.
Very funny. Even your question's funny in English.
Yes. Okay. But his answer was excellent. It'll be free. So why am I doing all that? Because we have other places in the Bible where they do play with the language, especially with foreigners. So we may be running into that here in our story. Meanwhile, so that we can get some meat to this and not just have some interesting cultural background, let's turn to Isaiah and start reading through line by line and look at some of the parallels. We'll look at some of the parallels for the first four verses. Then I'm going to jump to something very iconoclastic that I think is out of sequence or out of character, so that we can raise a larger question of interpretation. So, the Lord's Spirit will rest on him. Well, that sounds very much like Joseph. Of course, this is a messianic prophecy. The first verse said, a root out of Jesse's stock. That's David's line. This is Isaiah writing a couple hundred years after David. And so the people will understand that this is a prophetic proclamation about David's line, God's overall purposes. In this sense, the restoration of David's line into something ideal, to fulfill the promises that God wants to bring about through David. So the Spirit of the Lord will rest on him. Well, is that true of Joseph?
Yeah.
Yes. A spirit that gives extraordinary wisdom. Hey. That sounds like Joseph too, doesn't it? A spirit that provides the ability to execute plans. And that's very Josephian, because Joseph had a plan and he executed it to provide for Egypt during a time of trouble. A spirit that produces absolute loyalty to the Lord. And, of course, we're talking about the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit dwelling on the leader, dwelling on the messianic leader, and we can think of the Messiah. We can think, we can also come forward, if you want, from Isaiah's time to the time of Jesus. We think of the Spirit of the Lord resting on him as a dove, and that this is part of the messianic anointing. Okay, that, those links, those spiritual links between Joseph in terms of being a typology of wisdom and the Lord's guidance and the prophecy in Isaiah and the way Jesus as the Messiah had to lead and live his life here on earth, those links are pretty clear. I like the next verse. He will take delight in obeying the Lord. Reminds me of a psalm also where, you know, I delight to do your will, O Lord. He will not judge by mere appearances. And of course, this is one of the high points of any understanding of justice. You don't get swayed by, by somebody that's rich, by poor, somebody that is more beautiful than the other person, more refined. You look at the substance. I could quote something from the news. There is no two-tiered justice system. If you haven't heard that in the news, don't worry. Not worth going there. Not judge by mere appearances or make decisions on the basis of hearsay. Justice gets to the truth of the matter, not just what people might assume. And that also will affect us in our interpretation many times. Sometimes our first assumption isn't the best. You have to dig down. He will treat the poor fairly. Another hallmark of justice. It's a hallmark of wisdom throughout the Bible, Hebrew Bible, Greek New Testament. Treating the poor fairly is the hallmark of justice and wisdom. Now we have a little shift. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth and order the wicked to be executed. So justice is not just good news for the innocent, but it's also bad news for the wicked. The wicked will be taken down and executed. And I'm sorry?
Rod of his mouth and the breath of his lips.
The breath of his lips. Yes. This says here the breath of his lips, specifically in this context, his official decrees that the wicked oppressors would be judged. That's, in other words, they have interpreted, what does that mean? Breath of his lips, these are his judgments. So, but that's very good. Thank you for calling that. And I overlooked that because I was looking at a translation that had already interpreted the metaphor.
In Hebrew, is the word for the rod of his mouth in 4 the same as the shoot in 11:1? Achoter. Achoter is 11:1. What is it in?
Yes.
What
no, it's not Shevet. The kotel.
Shevet
is down here. And yes, up there it was hotel.
Hotel is in 11:1, I know.
But hotel isn't a... hotel is a kind of a piece of wood, whereas a shevet is talking about... isn't necessarily wooden, and now we're talking about a symbol of rule.
Okay.
Let's try to move on a little bit. Justice like a belt around his waist, integrity like a belt around his hips. That's pretty straightforward. Now, this description, and thank you, Sharon, for already tying in Genesis 1, this description talks about a restoration of the natural order where animals are not devouring or hurting each other, including us. But I want to skip over that and come back in just a minute, because there was another... I forgot to do that in Genesis 41, but this question of all... The famine was in all the earth, all the lands of the earth. How big was that famine? Did that mean that during Joseph's famine, the Inca had no crops?
No, I think it's the known world, isn't it?
Perhaps the known world. But I'm even wondering if some of the edges of the known world... In other words, the fact that they had a famine in Canaan and in Egypt, did that mean that they also had a famine in Babylon?
Interesting question.
You know, the Genesis.
Yes, Genesis.
Short stories and historical stories.
Yes.
Okay. And in the meantime, there is a sense of prophecy. The story of Joseph is fulfilled in Jesus.
Right.
Both in his first and second coming.
Mm-hmm. Good.
So everything in Genesis is prophecies. If we dig deep in the story, this story of stories, I found many.
Okay, very good. But it still brings us back to the historical interpretation. How do we interpret it when the story says all the earth? Just how big of an all the earth is that? And
that was local, Middle East, Egypt, and the Middle East. Then it's global.
Well, it's in any case, I bring that up because here we have in Isaiah 11. We have someone that's going to be a signal flag for the nations. And here I think they are specifically trying to make it a little more global because they have their known world. They have Assyria, Egypt, Cush, which is south of Egypt. This is Africa. Shinar, Hamat, I assume is the Levo Hamat north of in northern Syria, and the sea coasts. He'll lift up a flag for the nations. He'll gather the dispersed people, and it's very much a messianic vision. If someone wants to refer to this as a millennial vision, where you have the Lord ruling from Jerusalem over the whole earth. I'd like to jump so that you feel the clang, the clash. Jump down to from verse 13, where we have this messianic vision of the knowledge of the earth, of the knowledge of the knowledge of the Lord covering the earth, covering the seas. Now in verse 14 it says, they will swoop down on the Philistine hills to the west, and they'll loot the people to the east. They'll take over Edom and Moab, and the Ammonites will be their subjects. And all of a sudden you think, what happened to their vision? They're looking at the whole world. The Lord has his regent ruling out of Jerusalem over the whole world, and now they're raiding Ashkelon for booty? What is that? You know, they're crossing the Dead Sea to go over to Moab for some booty?
Fitting metaphor.
just small-minded. I mean, you know, on one hand, it's the whole world, and then the next minute, we're talking about what's happening up the street.
It says here, they shall not hurt nor destroy in my holy mountain. It doesn't say the Lord, does it?
It doesn't say what?
It says in my holy mountain. They won't hurt, they won't destroy in my holy mountain.
But that's at the end of verse 11, I believe.
No, 9. All my hope. For the
yes.
earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord.
Yes,
the
that was verse 9, but yeah. I'm jumping down to verse 14. It's verse 14 where we have this very abrupt break. And I point this out so that you become accustomed to some of the difficulty of dealing with prophetic discourse. Prophetic discourse is not always easy to apply
no.
to a real life. And I don't know how to apply verse 14 together.
You can say second application and a third application.
And a third.
Which, you know, encompass the whole world.
And it looks like we're backing up in verse 14, talking about something very local. This is something that might have interested them in the 8th century. It doesn't interest us today. And look at the next verse, 15. The Lord will divide the gulf of the Egyptian sea. He'll wave his hand over the Euphrates River. He'll dry it up. And there'll be a highway from Assyria so that the remnant of his people, just like it was for Israel when they left Egypt. So now we have something again on this very end of the world messianic kind of viewpoint, bringing in the people from all over, walking across the dry Euphrates River, duplicating the Exodus. And now we can come back. So here we have a duplication of the Exodus in a very messianic end of the world sort of scenario, or a millennial sort of scenario. Whereas right in the middle we had one verse that talked about getting a little extra wealth out of the Philistines, and you wonder, what in the world is that verse doing there in the middle of this prophecy? And I confessed at the beginning, I don't know. Now we come back to this other, how do you interpret this, and how do you interpret animals in Genesis 1? We can say that the lion and the lamb lying down together, eating grass, eating straw, this is like Genesis 1, where there's no mention of people eating each other. And yet, as anybody will tell you, you know, open up a lion's mouth or a bear's mouth or a wolf's mouth and don't look in the mirror yourselves. And what do you see? You see what they call canine teeth. You get these big, long teeth that are able, are they able to mow grass? No. They're able to rip meat. They're good for ripping meat. They're terrible for trying to chew grass. We have molars for chewing grass, but we have these dagger teeth for ripping meat, ripping flesh off of animals. So, did lions have canine teeth? Did lions have meat-eating teeth when they were created? And if they did, somebody said no. But if they were lions and they had canine-eating, you know, flesh-eating teeth, why were they created with flesh-eating teeth if they're eating grass? And if, in fact, they were created to eat meat, and that was part of God's purposes, and they were created that way, then how do we interpret Isaiah 11? And how do you interpret Genesis 1? So, since you brought that up, Miss Sharona, I am going to ask you to take the first step forward.
Did you mention the connection between Ruach Adonai and both passages?
That's what we started with.
Even in the prophecies. Said, even in the
yes.
It includes symbols. For example, waters of Euphrates.
Yes.
The same revelation. It means people's tongues, nations. The waters means people's tongues, nations.
Yes, but in this context, the water is showing God's power to do a miracle so that his people can reduplicate the Exodus.
Right.
In the Exodus, they crossed over dry land, and so it says, and in the future, even the mighty Euphrates, God will make into dry land so his people can walk back.
Yeah, this one means people, tongues, nations, etc., etc. It's in Revelation 17.
Yes, that's Revelation, but that's different. Anyway, what you did say that is excellent, on target, is that these are symbols. These are pictures. I like to think of prophecy as pastel watercolors. Prophecies are meant to be wrestled with so that we can extract things from it as to how then we should live, but they are pastel water pictures, and the details are not supposed to be pressed into every every nook and cranny. There are many details that won't fit. And if they don't fit, don't worry about it. Look at the big picture. If they do fit, that's great. You know, if in the pastel it talks about and this person is going to be buried with the rich, his place is with the wicked and he'll be buried with the rich, and you go, I wonder what that would mean, and you read it like a pastel, and then you find out it's literally fulfilled, great. But, yes?
Can we go back to another connection of Ani?
Say more quickly.
Okay, so the Spirit of God is in Isaiah 11.
Yes.
And the Spirit of God is on Joseph.
Yes.
Joseph, when he names his children, he says, because God has multiplied me in the land of my poverty, right?
Yes.
Only ye.
Yes.
And so also this messianic figure, you can call him Ben Yosef.
Or Ben David.
And he's going to judge with justice the poor people.
Yes.
And then he's going to prove straightly the humble of the earth. And so it's a synonym with oni.
Yes.
Anad. So you have the connection, the verbal connection of Joseph being in the land of his poverty, and then the poor of the earth that this
decides
where to judge.
But does that answer the question of the animal imagery?
No, because I don't think there's time to answer that.
Okay,
question.
Well, let me give a one-sentence answer. And that is, maybe this is a case of pastel watercolors, and the whole animal imagery is meant to lead us into treating everyone with justice and not trying to devour each other. Just like the animals in this picture do not devour each other, so will human beings in this messianic age will not be devouring each other. And if God works it out so that lions quit eating animal protein for their diet, then that will be wonderful. And I haven't a clue. I have no idea how that will work out, because the world I live in has lions that are made for eating flesh. But I can take that imagery of the animal kingdom restored to an idyllic and in some senses unreal image, but it doesn't matter whether it's real or not, because the image is telling me how I should live.
Not to devour.
And it's not just how I... Here's the nice thing about prophecy. It's not just about, I'm going to live like that when the Lord comes back. That's also telling us how we should live today.
Amen.
The justice, that's in the prophecy, looking to the future, is also for how we should aspire to live today. And that is a nice introduction to the application and difficulty of dealing with prophetic discourse that is wonderfully highlighted in this short little section of verses. And with that, we have to close, and so I have to say, but I'm happy to say, Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you very much.
Now, how do we turn this off? I'll try the...
I don't know how to turn off your machine, Gary.
Well, I thought I did.